This is the beginning of a study on the book of Colossians. And before we get going in chapter 1, I really need to spend a bit of time giving some background material. And this will help us as we get into the text. And just by way of introduction, I should mention the primary sources that I've used in developing this series. A good bit is from my own study over the years, but I've also drawn on the IVP New Testament Commentary Series, which, by the way, is one of the few modern commentaries available free online. Then I've used the Word New Testament Commentary on Colossians by Peter O'Brien and N.T. Wright's commentary in the Tyndale series on Colossians. There are, of course, many, many other good commentaries on Colossians available. And as there are only about five, six, or seven, I'm not sure, lectures in this study, I'd encourage you to fill out the gaps by referring to one or two more commentaries. In a study like this, there's so much I have to leave out. And this book is so rich that it really repays any time you can invest in it on your own. Now, normally, the so-called prison epistles of Paul are listed as Colossians, where in Colossians 4:3, Paul speaks about being in chains, Ephesians, Philemon, and Philippians. They were more or less written together, although Philippians probably came a bit later. And for some of this time, Paul was under house arrest, a kind of electronic tagging in the ancient world. But the reference to being in chains suggests that also in this period, he was actually imprisoned and literally in chains. The letter to Philemon was probably carried to Colossae along with Ephesians by Paul's fellow worker Tychicus, and the runaway slave Onesimus was probably traveling with him and returning to his master Philemon at Colossae after, of course, finding the Lord as a runaway slave in Rome under Paul's ministry. During Paul's 3 years in Ephesus, the whole province of Asia was evangelized. Asia in the ancient world, referring, of course, to a province within the modern-day state of Turkey. We read, you remember in Acts 19, verse 10, that during Paul's time in Ephesus, quote, all who lived in Asia heard the word of the Lord. And Colossae itself was about 100 miles from Ephesus, and it was probably during the time that Paul was headquartered at Ephesus, that three-year period, that Colossae was evangelized and the church planted. But Paul did not go there himself. As he says in Colossians 1:7, you learned the gospel from Epaphras, our dear fellow servant. So it was probably planted by Epaphras, and there's no record of Paul going there. Of course, he might have. It might not just be in the text of Acts, but he does say that they learnt the gospel from Epaphras. And Epaphras, as well as being described as a faithful minister of the Colossian church, he is connected in Colossians 1:7 and Colossians 4:12 and 13, is connected with church plants in Hierapolis and Laodicea. And again, cities that, as far as we know, Paul himself did not visit. And it was probably Epaphras who originally also carried the good news. I shouldn't say the good news. It was probably Epaphras who originally carried the news, it wasn't good, to Paul in prison, that a dangerous heresy was brewing in the church at Colossae. And Paul responds to this by writing the letter. Now, Laodicea, Hierapolis, and Colossae were very close together geographically. Hierapolis and Laodicea stood on either side of what was called the Lycus Valley, a very beautiful area through which the river Lycus flowed, and they were only 6 miles apart. And then the city of Colossae straddled the river 12 miles further upstream. Laodicea was the political and financial center of the district and was very wealthy. Of course, we read about that in the book of Revelation. Hierapolis was a trade center and apparently had a very famous spa. In fact, people came in their thousands from all around the region to bathe and to drink the waters that were supposed to be very health-giving in that city. And the ruins of Hierapolis and Laodicea can be visited today in Turkey. You can go there and see the ancient ruins, as you can at Ephesus. But there are no remains of the small town of Colossae. Tom Wright mentions that the famous commentator Lightfoot says that Colossae was the most unimportant town to which Paul ever wrote a letter. And in addition, Colossians is one of the shortest of Paul's epistles. But God is no respecter of persons, and to this unimportant town, and through this very short letter, some crucial insights of the gospel that we would not have otherwise known have now gone out to the ends of the earth, to the nations of the world. And also, one of the greatest Christological passages in the New Testament is found in Colossians 1, as we'll discover when we get there shortly. Now, there are a number of hints in the letter itself that the church was mainly made up of Gentiles. Paul speaks of the Colossians as being those who had once been strangers to the covenants of promise. He would never say that to Jews. And in Colossians 3, verses 5 and 7, he gives a list of how they behaved before they came to know the Lord. And all the sins he mentions were very characteristic of the sins of the Gentiles. However, there was also a large population in these cities. One estimate puts the Jewish population in this region at about 50,000. And so they would have been well represented in the church, even though it was predominantly made up of Gentiles. And this is important, as it explains why there was a lot of pressure on the church from the Jewish false teachers, who, by the way, are often called Judaizers or agitators in the commentaries. A lot of pressure from them at this point. You see, the Jewish believers in Jesus were under pressure from the Judaizers, even though the Judaizers, the agitators, themselves claimed to be believers, but the Jewish believers in Jesus were under pressure to retain the old Jewish ways, keeping the law of Moses as well as believing in Jesus, and the Gentile converts were under pressure to start embracing the works of the law of Moses. However, scholars hold a variety of views about the exact nature of the heresy Paul is arguing against in chapter 2. But while we can't be totally sure, the best approach seems to be that he's warning them against the teaching that all believers, be they Jew or Gentiles, had to be circumcised and follow the law of Moses if they were fully to follow Jesus. A similar situation had arisen in the Galatian church, but had gained far more ground there, which is why Paul hits it so hard in his letter to the Galatians. I think it was Tom Wright who illustrated the situation something like this. Imagine a group today breaking away from Orthodox Christianity and forming a sect. Then we send in some biblical scholars to point out their theological errors, to point out in a loving way how they had gone astray. Now, for most of them, the pressure they would feel, having been shown this from the scriptures, to come back to the historic faith would be very powerful. And this is why Paul insists that his gospel is the fulfillment of true Orthodox historic Judaism, is not a new sect. However, by way of contrast to my illustration, or Tom Wright's illustration, the Colossians had not left the Orthodox camp. They'd not left the Orthodox camp and joined a new religion, but rather the reverse is true. Embracing Jesus as the Messiah is the continuation and the consummation of historic Judaism. And now to go back, to compromise grace with law, would simply be a disaster. However, from what we read in Colossians, there was another element to the heresy that was infecting the church. Although Gnosticism was a second century movement, there were elements of it around in the first century. And 1 John would be a good example of an epistle that exposes it as false teaching. Now, it would take more time than I have here to discuss the various dimensions of Gnosticism, but among other things, they believed that the human spirit alone was good, and that matter was essentially evil. They described our spiritual capacity as a spark from God within us, and therefore taught asceticism as a way, denying yourself, denying the body, as a way of demonstrating the primacy of the spirit over matter, including the human body. Or they could go in the other direction and teach that what we do with our bodies doesn't really matter. As for them, matter didn't really matter. Only the human spirit was important, and therefore behavior such as sexual immorality was unimportant, simply because matter did not matter that much. And many Jews were sympathetic to Gnosticism while still remaining in their own way committed to the Torah. They did not necessarily see them as incompatible, which of course they most certainly were incompatible. And so it would seem that what's called in the commentaries the Colossian heresy was a combination of the elements of a kind of embryonic Gnosticism alongside the teaching that believers still had to keep the Jewish law. It's not exactly clear how they link the two, but this is about as far as we can get in attempting to understand what was going on. In this very short introduction, I'll not deal with the debate among the scholars as to where Paul was actually in prison when he wrote the letter. Some say Caesarea. You'll remember that in Acts 24, Paul was imprisoned there for some time. Others say Rome, as we read in Acts 28, and still others say it was an earlier imprisonment in Ephesus that was not recorded in the book of Acts. And remember that in 1 Corinthians 11:23, Paul says, quote, "I have been in prison frequently." So there were imprisonments of Paul that were not recorded in the book of Acts. Now, many modern scholars have decided on Ephesus as the location of this particular imprisonment, and therefore the place from which Colossians was written. However, I'm going to take the traditional view that Rome was the location, which seems to be backed up by the reference to the gospel becoming known among Caesar's Praetorian Guard, Caesar's bodyguard. That's in Philippians 1:22. you'll remember, he says, it's become known among the Praetorian Guard that my imprisonment is for Christ. And also at the end of Philippians 4:22, where he says, those of Caesar's household, obviously those who have believed in Caesar's household, send you greetings. And remember that Colossians and Philippians were written at about the same time. Now, it's possible that these statements could refer to the Roman garrison at Ephesus or Caesarea, but it seems more likely that it was Rome. And all this doesn't make much difference, except that if the location was Ephesus, that would put the date of the letter much earlier, somewhere between 52 and 55 AD, when Paul was working in Ephesus, as we read in Acts 19. Tom Wright points out that the relationship in actual content between the letter of Colossians and the letter to the Ephesians is very close. When we read the two letters side by side, we repeatedly notice many parallels. However, Ephesians does not have the great Christological hymn that we find in Colossians, or Ephesians does not have the attack against false teaching that we find in Colossians. And as I said, Paul probably wrote them very close together, writing Colossians first and then Ephesians. And for this reason, the one is somewhat an echo of the other. Possibly after Paul had finished Colossians, he decided to write to Ephesus, as it was close geographically to Colossae, and it would be convenient to send the letters together, as they would need to have been carried by hand. And having said all that by way of introduction, we can move on to chapter 1. But it's important to remember that knowing the background is not simply academic. It actually affects the way we interpret some of the passages. So it might seem a bit tedious, but it's important if we're to grasp the significance of the epistle as a whole.